Welcome to Maximizing Social Impact, a podcast of Dallas Social Venture Partners. My name is Brian Weinberg. I'll be your guest host. And joining me today is Mr. Sam Daly-Harris, the founder of Results and the director of the Microcredit Summit Campaign. And we'll be discussing microfinance. Welcome.
Well, it's good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming to Dallas. We're really excited to have you. Just to start off, if you could just kind of give, from your perspective, what is microfinance?
Well, there's this simple answer, and then I'll give the longer one. Simply put, microfinance is small loans and other financial services like savings and insurance and the like, often to poor and very poor people around the world. But I think that doesn't really give you a flavor for how revolutionary it is. And I'm always reminded of being with Muhammad Yunus of the Grameen Bank 20 years ago when he would be asked what his strategy was in forming Grameen Bank. And he would say, I didn't have a strategy. I just kept doing what was next. But when I look back, my strategy was whatever banks did, I did the opposite. If banks lent to the rich, I lent to the poor. If banks lent to men, I lent to women. If banks made large loans, I made small ones. If banks required collateral, my loans were collateral free. If banks required a lot of paperwork, my loans were illiterate friendly. If you had to go to the bank, my bank went to the village. Yes, that was my strategy. Whatever banks did, I did the opposite. So at some level, I would argue that microfinance is a revolution in banking, or a breaking the rules of banking to even exist.
Wow, thank you. And your role has just been, you know, part of the revolution, really. And so in that, I'd like for you to briefly explain or bring us up to speed about your role in microfinance from the early stages to the Nobel Peace Prize to now.
Well, first of all, the role of my organizations or the ones that I founded, like Results and the Microcredit Summit campaign, was the role of an advocate, not as a practitioner. So it was a different kind of role. Our route in, and I'm going to tell the shorter version of this, was in 1985 when we first learned about it. We were lobbying, a grassroots lobby on ending global poverty. We were lobbying on behalf of a small UN agency in Rome called the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD. And in 1985, they sent us three documentaries about three programs they'd invested in. And one of the documentaries was a Dutch documentary on a little bank in Bangladesh with 42,000 borrowers called the Grameen Bank. And so our 50 chapters in 27 states would watch this video. And by the next year, 1986, we were having members of Congress introduce legislation on what was called microenterprise development at the time. And in 1987, the Results volunteers generated 100 editorials in newspapers across the United States on microfinance. And so that was the early stages of it. We organized the Microcredit Summit in 1997, about 10 years later, 10 years ago. And there were more than 2,900 delegates who came to Washington for this microcredit summit. Presidents, prime ministers, first ladies, queens, and the top practitioners at the time around the world. There are some of the largest MFIs in the world didn't even exist in 1997, and launched a 9-year campaign to reach 100 million of the world's poorest families, especially the women, with credit for self-employment and other financial and business services. So that was 1997. And the next year, 1998, the UN passed a resolution calling 2005 the year of microcredit, because that was the year that our goal was due. So 2005, the year of microcredit, came out of the Microcredit Summit campaign, but we didn't actually have much influence on that year ourselves. And then in 1986, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so
when
2006. In 2006, which is now just a few years ago, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so when we were very much involved in that and in us getting him nominated by the right nominators and that kind of thing.
So one thing that's so unique about the microfinance industry is that there's so many people looking at it, so much innovation going on. So my next question to you would be, what would be the most exciting innovation and the most difficult challenge for the microfinance industry as you see it?
Well, first of all, the most exciting innovation is tough because there are lots of exciting innovations. I mean, there's technological innovations that can bring costs down. There are innovations regarding using microfinance, as Alex Counts of Grameen Foundation talks about it, as a platform for other services, whether it's health or other kinds of interventions, cell phones and the like. There are all kinds of new products, insurance products and the like. So it's a world of innovation. For me, the most exciting is the innovations that I see going on in at Jamii Bora in Kenya in urban slums. In other words, the giants of the field, the Muhammad Yunuses of Grameen, the Fazil Abids of BRAC, and so many of the other giants of the world did most of their innovation, most of their genius was in rural areas in Bangladesh and elsewhere around the world. So what's particularly unique is the work that Jamii Bora is doing in urban slums, not urban areas, urban slums with beggars and prostitutes and thieves and gang members. Total breakthroughs in terms of changing people's lives. I mean, I could tell a quick story that'll give you a sense of that. I was with the founder of Jamii Bora in May, and she said after the post-election violence in Kenya in about 2008, we were given money to rebuild one of the markets that was destroyed in the rioting. And so Jamii Bora said, we have to find the rioters who destroyed the market and engage them in rebuilding it. Now, I really don't know of many microfinance groups in the world that, if given funds to rebuild a market destroyed in violence, would say we have to find the rioters and engage them in rebuilding it. But anyway, Jamii Bora said that and did that because all of their staff are former members, are former beggars or prostitutes or gang leaders or whatever. So they found the gang leader, known as the general and the deputy general, the Gang of 200, and they started talking with him, the staff, about rebuilding the market that they destroyed. And when he first met Ingrid Monroe, the head of Jamii Bora, he said, I was very upset at your staff when they first came to me because they didn't realize how dangerous I was. But anyway, they talked to him and they convinced them, and they paid the gang to guard the materials at night, and they paid the gang to rebuild the market with others during the day. And when it was over, they engaged the general and the deputy general and about a third of the gang in microfinance. The rest were still skeptical. The general takes sheet metal and builds cases that school kids use to bring their stuff to and from school. So he came to Ingrid in May of 2009, and he said, you know, I haven't gone to my home village in 10 years because my mother is so ashamed of me. But I just went to my village, and my mother cried for 3 days because she was so happy about how I turned my life around. And I said at the Microcredit Summit in Colombia, in Latin America, in June of 2009, there's the vision of using microfinance to better end poverty, and there's the vision of using microfinance for redemption. The dictionary defines redemption as restoring one's honor and worth, setting one free. And I said, isn't that the highest vision for microfinance, to assist people in restoring their honor and worth, to assist them in breaking free from the bondage of poverty? So that's a glimpse into this kind of, you asked about breakthroughs or innovations that I see most exciting, and that's an example. It's a human breakthrough in a way. It's not there's technology involved in the way they operate, but it's really human breakthrough.
And for the most difficult challenge?
The most difficult challenge. Well, I think the most difficult challenge is the challenge of the difficulty that will come from looking at microfinance as a profit maximizing opportunity. I think that will send the field into a ditch, and it's a ditch that it may never get out of. So I think there are these basic assumptions like, well, if you give a microloan, someone's better off automatically. It always works. It's not true. I think there's an assumption, well, it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. If they're taking the loan and paying it back, that means they need it, and it doesn't matter. It's a nice thought, but it isn't necessarily true. And so I think if the field becomes overly focused on profit maximization, it'll die, really, actually. And so we'll see.
Okay. So in terms of here back into the United States, you know, we were talking about Kenya earlier, now back into the United States, how is all these things that are happening around the world relevant to these communities like Dallas-Fort Worth in United States?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple things. I think what's particularly relevant is the whole issue of innovation, not giving up on what people who are poor can do, and like working to find new ways, new innovations to make that happen. There is an organization, AEO, which is the Association of Enterprise Opportunity, which is the association of all the microfinance groups in the U.S. working in the U.S. And so they have a gathering once a year. It's usually in May. They'll have 600, 700, 800 people who are doing this kind of work. Maybe it's loans, maybe it's training, maybe it's both, all around the United States. And so there are all manner of groups. I'm thinking of New York City as one example. There are three key groups there right now. Acción is in New York. Project Enterprise is in New York, and Grameen America just entered New York City. And there are probably others, but those are three key that are doing this kind of work right there. And so I'm actually not familiar with microenterprise work in Dallas. There may be amazing stuff that I don't know about, but you know, people should really look around for it and see what's happening here, because it's definitely happening all around the United States and elsewhere. I mean, in Norway, in France, in England, et cetera.
So it's a global industry. People in the United States are receiving microloans. Just
yeah, and it's tougher. I mean, I remember there's a visit that Hillary Clinton did to Bangladesh when she was first lady, and one of the women in the village asked her, "Do you have cattle at your home too?" Which, of course, this woman had tied next to her hut or house, wherever she lived, but the White House didn't have any cattle, actually. There are different things that you can do in different settings, in different cities and countries. But still, I mean, it's, again, another way of looking at it is there's the challenge of maybe your competition, depending on what your business is Walmart. Well, that's a tough competitor in terms of pricing, et cetera, et cetera. How is your service better, and maybe your pricing better if possible, or maybe you're doing something else that isn't so competitive with some kind of purchasing power like a Walmart.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's just a completely different context.
Yeah,
but it is happening.
Yeah.
Okay, so for my last question, I'd just like to inquiry into your idea for the future of microfinance. And you know, Muhammad Yunus's most famous quote is, "We want to put poverty into the museums."
Yeah.
And the Microcredit Summit campaign has continued to set goals. And wanted to learn a little bit more about your thoughts on the future.
Well, I mean, I know that we talked about this before, and you were asking if there might be a date certain when the first poverty museum would open, or all the poverty museums would open. And what I think is certain is that we could go either way. End of poverty, a slam dunk? No. Poverty will always be with us? No. It really depends on us. It really depends on what we hold as valuable. I mean, it depends on what we put our attention to. And so when I look, as I described earlier, I'm going to talk tonight at the Junior Committee of the Chiapas Project, and I'm going to talk about the phrase return on investment. And when I tell the story, which I've not told here, of the first thief, the first criminal who got a microloan from Jamie Bora, who with $20 has then built 4 businesses. He's gotten more loans since then. And he's convinced hundreds of youth to get out of crime. I say, well, that's perhaps not the return on investment that the investor wants. Hundreds of youth getting out of crime. But it's certainly the return on investment that the world needs and that communities need and that people in despair like ourselves need. And so when I look down that road, I'm full of hope. You know, when I look down some other roads, you know, it's more challenging because we're off track in lots of different ways. So the future, obviously, is what we make it. And we don't know enough to be pessimistic.
Thank you. And thank you for all your work throughout the years and for joining us today. I'd also like to thank Kevin Slater, our sound engineer from DFW Video, and our executive producer, Stacey Caldwell, with Dallas Social Venture Partners.